Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island since 1988. Goose Island's been brewing beers in the spirit of Chicago.
You can find 312 Wheat Ale, Big Juicy Beer Hug, and so many other limited releases at either of Goose's locations in Chicago. Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
I've noticed a number of peculiar incidents among the members of the student body, all having to do with rock and roll music.
Wham bam, Benjamin!
Now, if you don't think this song is the greatest song ever, I will fight you.
I've never met a rock band that hasn't prepared for their tour by watching Spinal Tap. I'm Jim DeRogatis.
And I'm Greg Kot. We celebrate 30 years of Spinal Tap with director, writer, and star Rob Reiner. And then we review a new album from another rock and roll mythmaker, Morrissey. That's all coming up on Sound Opinions.
This is Sound Opinions, and later in the show, we're going to review the new album, the 10th solo record from Morrissey. Greg, we had Johnny Marr of the Smiths on the show, and that was fun, but I've never spoken to Maz, have you?
I did, Jim. This was years ago, in the early 90s, actually, and he just come off a show where the fans had climbed on stage and literally ripped his shirt off. And I said, what's going on there? He says, I understand what my fans want.
That happens to us a lot.
Yes, indeed. Well, we're going to find out if Maz still understands what his fans want. We're going to review that album later in the show. But first, we've got some music news.
Beat on the brat, beat on the brat, beat on the brat with the baseball bat.
That is the Ramones from 1976. Who else could it be with Beat on the Brat and the great Tommy Ramone on drums, leaving absolutely no space in that song for anything else. Just the driving locomotive of rhythm. The late, great Tommy Ramone. Tommy Erdele, dead at the age of 65, the last surviving original member of the Ramones, Jim. It's hard to say that, you know?
It really is.
Johnny, Joey, and Dee Dee Ramone all died within the last 15 years. Tommy was the last man standing from that original band that basically changed the face of rock and roll in the 70s. He was probably the least known, the most mysterious member. He was kind of the behind-the-scenes Svengali of this band in a way. He crafted their first press release. He was saying, the Ramones all originate from Forest Hills, New York, and kids who grew up there either become musicians, degenerates, or dentists. The Ramones are a little of each. Their sound is not unlike a fast drill on a rear molar. He was an experienced guy, Jim. He had worked with Hendrix in the studio as a studio engineer in 1970 before he came to the Ramones as their drummer, producer, and also songwriter.
And we talked to him on the show about working on Rocket to Russia. We're going to replay that show in a couple of weeks as a tribute. Two things I think people don't understand or appreciate about Tommy and the Ramones in general. Number one is, if you think that was simple drumming, because there's no fill on the first Ramones album until the very last song, right? Try to play it. You know, just try it. It's endurance. Their virtuosity was speed. Number two is the influence of this band. We can talk about the Rolling Stones or the Beatles. It's wonderful that McCartney's still out there. But this is a band that if you heard them and if you got them, they changed your life. And that can't be said of a lot of other groups. I was in Italy recently, and I was staying in this 900-year-old castle, and there's this little chapel at at the foot of the hill where the castle is. And there was this kid. He's this chubby little kid with the complete Johnny Bowl haircut. Mm-hmm. And he's with this girl, and they're sitting there, teens, 16 years old. And he had a Ramones shirt on. And he clearly didn't speak English, but I said to him, "Ramones!" And he gave me the power fist salute. And he said, "Tommy." And I had no idea what he meant. And I went back to the room and I checked Facebook, and Tommy was dead. Here is one of the songs that Tommy wrote, a classic for the Ramones, Blitzkrieg Bop, from that first album on Sound Opinions.
Hey, oh, let's go. Hey, oh, let's go. Hey, oh, let's go. Hey, oh, let's go. The bumping in the straight line. You're going through a tight one. You keep the listen, never mind. Blitzkrieg Bop. The pilot in the back seat.
That is the Ramones with Blitzkrieg Bop on Sound Opinions. The late, great Tommy Ramone wrote that song dead at the age of 65.
You're listening to Sound Opinions, and that is Rock and Roll Creation, performed by another of the most important bands in rock history, Spinal Tap. Fans first heard those dark tones in Rob Reiner's 1984 mockumentary chronicling a metal trio touring to promote its album Smell the Glove. Now, those aging headbangers are even older, 30 years older to be exact, but this is Spinal Tap remains, no doubt about it, the greatest rock and roll movie ever. It's one of the few absolutes, Greg, that we agree on. The reason is because, fictional or not, it is the truest. From the arenas to the airplane hangars, all of the cliched moments of excess and glad-handing, of sexism and machismo and utter stupidity, they all ring true.
Yeah, Jim, whether art imitates life or vice versa, there are real black albums in rock and roll, and there are real drummer tragedies in rock and roll. And I think that authenticity was thanks to the music-loving stars and writers of this movie. Michael McKean, Christopher Guest, Harry Shearer, and of course, the director and fellow writer, Rob Reiner. The man many of us came to know as Meathead in All in the Family plays the fake director Marty DeBerge in the movie. But in real life, he's directed classics like Stand By Me, The Princess Bride, When Harry Met Sally, and A Few Good Men. His new film has Diane Keaton and Michael Douglas in it, and So It Goes, it's called, and it's out July 25th. But Rob's been kind enough to indulge all our burning Spinal Tap questions, and we have a lot of them, in preparation for our July 29th screening of This Is Spinal Tap. We've turned it up to 11 by bringing it to Millennium Park in Chicago. Rob Reiner, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
We're in the presence of a legend, I can say that. And I would also have to say, you got off to a pretty damn good start
Rob, I just have to say, I've read this quote that you gave years ago. No matter what else you would do in your career, your tombstone would say Meathead.
That's correct. I could win the Nobel Prize. The headline would be Meathead Wins Nobel.
All due respect, sir. You're talking to two rock critics. Your tombstone's going to say Spinal Tap.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Or it might say there's a fine line between stupid and clever.
Their objections were that she was the victim. You see? That's all right. I mean, if the singer's the victim, it's different. It's not sexist.
He did a twist on it.
He did a twist, and it turned it around.
We should have thought of that.
We were so close.
I mean, if we'd had all you guys tied up, that probably would have been fine.
But it's still a stupid
It's such
couple. A fine line between stupid and clever.
Yeah, it's just clever. A little turnabout. Yeah.
Greg and I agree about so little in life. We agree that Spinal Tap is the greatest rock movie ever made.
Well, thank you.
It is the truest.
Is one of you guys a Republican and one of you guys a Democrat?
No, we're not quite that.
Not that far apart.
It's not that red-blue.
Oh,
no.
Okay, all right.
But we want to know about the young Rob as a music fan. When you're a kid growing up, you know, in this famous household, what kind of music were you listening to?
Well, I grew up in the 50s. You know, I was a kid in the 50s and in the, you know, came of age in the 60s. I listened to the first era of rock and roll. I mean, I had a whole stack of 45s. I was one of, like the guy in Diner. I could tell you what was on the flip side of, you know, Bye Bye Love. And you know, I listened to Everly Brothers and Roy Orbison and, you know, all, you know, the great stars of the 50s. That's what I grew up on. My mom, you know, who was a great singer. She actually launched a singing career in when she was 65 years old. She sang a lot of Ella Fitzgerald type stuff. Sarah Vaughan and Nina Simone and those kinds of people. So I heard a lot of that music, you know, early 40s, you know, kind of jazz, scat kind of music. But I heard a lot of, you know, I grew up basically, I'm the first generation in rock and roll.
Yeah. And the generation gap. I mean, you know, I know what it was like with my dad. It was like, man, he couldn't stand that noise, you know?
Well, you know, it's interesting. My dad didn't really get all that, but my mother really dug all the things that young kids were listening to. Mm. She loved all that stuff.
Well, you describe almost a Stand By Me type soundtrack with the 50s greats. I just have this vision in my head of pre-Meathead Rob Reiner in his bedroom with Carl bouncing in and you're jamming on Black Sabbath and him saying, what is this noise?
Yeah, well, I wasn't a Black Sabbath guy. I was not a headbanger type of guy. In the 60s, I was more of a, well, you know, obviously I love the Beatles and the Stones and the whole British invasion, but, you know, I liked Buffalo Springfield and I liked Country Joe and the Fish and I liked, you know, Hendrix and Janis Joplin and, you know, I was more into that than the heavy metal stuff.
Mm-hmm. You went to film school, right?
Well, I went to UCLA. Yeah. I was in the theater department, actually, at UCLA.
And apparently the story goes that you knew Ray Manzarek and Jim Morrison.
Well, yeah. I mean, they were in the film department there.
Yeah.
And, I'd see those guys. I mean, this is pre-Doors days, you know. Jim was an actor at the time. He wanted to act and stuff. So I'd see these guys, but I didn't, you know, this is way before, you know, they formed the Doors. But then I became a huge fan of the Doors And I remember one time going backstage. I mean, Jim was out there, you know, and he would sometimes he would just, you know, leave the stage, you know, and I asked Ray Manzarek about this, and he said, yeah, you know, we finish the set a lot these days without Jim, you know.
This is the
improv acting, improv rock and roll.
Well, the interesting thing about it is during the 60s, I was with an improv group called The Committee, which was a group that came from San Francisco. It was an offshoot of Second City. The group came from Chicago and started in San Francisco. And we had a lot of cross-pollination between the rock and roll world. We had Janis Joplin came on stage with us and performed with us. You know, we'd have the Steve Miller Band guys come around and Mamas and Papas. We had a lot of people hanging out. And that really became the basis for how we understood how rock and roll people behaved. And that's why I think, and even, you know, Chris, Harry, and Michael played in bands, you know. So even though we were comedians and satirists, we understood that rock and roll world pretty well.
Your first drummer was
the Beeper.
John Stumpy Peeps.
Oh, yeah.
Great, tall, blonde geek with glasses.
Yeah.
Good drummer.
Great look, good drummer,
good,
yeah.
Good
yeah,
drummer.
Fine.
What happened to him?
He died. He died in a bizarre gardening accident some years back.
It's really one of those things. It was, you know, the authorities said, you know, best leave it, you know,
it's not
unsolved,
about,
really. You know.
And he was replaced by...
Stumpy Joe. Eric Stumpy
Eric
Joe.
Child. Child. Yeah,
Stumpy and
Eric.
What happened to Stumpy Joe?
Well, it's not a very pleasant story, but...
No.
He died, he choked on, the official explanation was he choked on vomit.
It was actually,
away.
It was actually someone else's vomit. It's not...
It's ugly.
You know, there's no real...
Well, they can't prove whose vomit it was. They
no.
never, they don't have no. facilities
no
in Scotland Yard
no
to print
You can't really dust for vomit.
What was the genesis of the nugget of the idea of let's do a fictional documentary about a metal band in particular?
Well, here's what happened. Harry Shearer and I, we had done this thing called The TV Show, and it was a satire of different things on television. It was like a precursor to SCTV. Mm. And we did a piece on it, which was a takeoff of Midnight Special, which was a, you know, a late night rock and roll show hosted by Wolfman Jack.
Yeah.
And I played Wolfman Jack in that, and I introduced this heavy metal band. We made it up, Spinal Tap, England's loudest band. And that was the first time Spinal Tap ever appeared. I mean, we had they did a song I think called Rock and Roll Nightmare.
And now from England, half might say you gonna love them to death. Spinal Tap.
Russ Kunkel actually played drums.
Great drummer.
You know, great drummer, you know, played for Linda Ronstadt and Jackson Browne. And Loudon Wainwright was a keyboardist. He was a friend of ours. So we had this band. And, you know, while we were doing this the sketch, Chris, Harry, and Michael started improvising in those characters. And I thought, gee, what a great thing to be able to do something else with these characters. Then we didn't think about it much. Harry and I went off, and we had an idea for a movie called about roadies, you know, the backstage and, you know, on a tour. And then this movie named Roadie came out with Meatloaf starring in it. And we said, no, you know, we can't do that now. They've done this. Yeah. Meanwhile, Chris and Michael had done this little videotape of these two guys who run into each other in a hotel and in this drug haze kind of remembered that they worked in a band together. And they were improvising, Nigel and David St. Hubbins, you know. And so we saw this and we said, wait a minute, let's all get together and see if we can create a movie for this. And basically what we did is I went to a company named Marble Arch. I said, look, let us write this thing for you. And, you know, it'll be a rock and roll documentary. They gave us some money and we've realized that there was no way in screenplay form we could capture what this was going to be because it was going to be documentary. So I said to the guy, give us the money you were going to give us to write the screenplay. I'll make you a little bit of the film. And we made like 20 minutes of this film. You know, we had backstage footage, we had concert footage, I did interview stuff, and then the guy said, I don't like this, you know? And so we went around for like years trying to get it made, and finally we were able to put it together for a couple of $1 million.
We'll have more Spinal Tap talk with Rob Reiner after a quick break here on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX. And later, the more you ignore him, the closer he gets. Morrissey is back with a new solo album.
You've got a take two, won't you take it with me? What a gay time it will be. Cups and cakes, please make sure that nothing breaks. The china's so dear and the treacle's so clear, and I'm glad that you are here. Milk and sugar, bread and jam. Yes, please, sir, and thank you, ma'am. Here I am. Cups and cakes, cups and cakes. I'm so full, my tummy aches. How sad it must end, but I'm glad I'd a friend sharing cups and cakes with me, and cakes with me.
Hello, my name is Marty DeBurgi. I'm a filmmaker. I make a lot of commercials. That little dog that chases the covered wagon underneath the sink, that was mine. In 1966, I went down to Greenwich Village, New York City, to a rock club called the Electric Banana. Don't look for it. It's not there anymore. But that night, I heard a band that, for me, redefined the word rock and roll. I remember being knocked out by their exuberance, their raw power, and their punctuality. That band was Britain's now legendary Spinal Tap.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Jim DeRogatis with Greg Kot, and that's Gimme Some Money, performed by the Thamesmen. The Thamesmen, of course, went on to become the immortal heavy metal band Spinal Tap, and we've been looking back at the rockumentary's legacy on its 30th anniversary with director, writer, and star Rob Reiner.
Rob, there have been a lot of stories about the genesis of Spinal Tap, particularly the script or the lack thereof. Fran Drescher, who plays the publicist Bobby Fleckman in the movie, has said there were 27 pages. I've heard as little as 4 pages.
It was 4 pages.
Yeah.
We basically, all we did was outline what the tour was and essentially what the idea of the film was, that it was going to be about these two guys who knew each other in the Squatney section of London. And they formed a skiffle band, and then they eventually became, you know, Spinal Tap. And that was all. That's all we had, and we knew the characters, and then we did write a Bible, you know, getting into the characters, who they were, you know, what the albums were, and all that. We knew the venues they were going to play. We had the characters, and we just started improvising. The whole film was improvised.
I had a long conversation about this movie with Roger Ebert, my colleague at the
right.
Sun-Times, you know, and he loved it too. And I remember him saying one of the things he loved about it was not only was it pitch perfect in capturing the rock and roll world, but it really, he loved documentaries. You know, he was such a huge fan. He said it parodied the documentary form. And I wonder about that from your perspective in particular as a filmmaker, because Marty DeBurg, right?
Marty DeBurg, yes.
Right?
That
Marty
was taken,
Scorsese
yeah,
and The
yeah.
Last Waltz.
That's
right?
exactly where it came from. We screened every single rock and roll, you know, from the Bob Dylan, you know.
Don't Look Back.
Don't Look Back, and to The Kids Are All Right, and The Song Remains the Same. The Led Zeppelin. We watched them all, and basically this became an amalgam of all those documentaries, and my character was based on Marty Scorsese from The Last Waltz.
And Jonathan Taplin, who produced Mean Streets, introduced Robbie to me, and said... there's going to be a lot of people at the concert, and the band, I felt, was important to, as a group and a figure in music, to record their last concert. And I figured at least it would be a reportage, you know, if anything. Mm-hmm. And then when we saw the results, we decided to shoot it in 35 millimeter. And I placed the camera in seven 35 millimeter cameras. In certain
seven?
Positions. Yeah, seven.
It's funny because he's so sort of obsequious, you know. And the rock journalist in me always says, I'd ask them a million questions. And he's, you know, asking these kind of obvious questions. And they, of course, give the ultra obvious answers.
Yeah, yeah. No, and what I liked is that Marty put himself in the movie.
Yeah.
You know, so I thought, I'm going to put myself in the movie.
What were your writing contributions above and beyond Chris's and Michael's? And-
well, we like I said, it was improvised.
Yeah.
I did help contribute to the lyrics of the songs. Mm-hmm. We all wrote the songs together. And all the interview footage I did, I never told them what I was going to ask them. Mm. Never told them what questions I was going to ask. So it was brilliant. I mean, you know, when it said, you know, you can't dust for vomit. I mean, you know, you don't come up with that, you know. So when I said, you know, hear this review of Shark Sandwich. And I said, it's just a two-word review. It says, sandwich. I just sprung that on them, and he says, "Well, that's not a review. That's just a word."
Let's talk about your reviews a little bit regarding intravenous DeMilo. This tasteless cover is a good indication of the lack of musical invention within. The musical growth rate of this band cannot even be charted. They are treading water in a sea of retarded sexuality and bad poetry.
Well, that's nitpicking, isn't it?
The Gospel According to Spinal Tap. This pretentious, ponderous collection of religious rock psalms is enough to prompt the question, what day did the Lord create Spinal Tap, and couldn't he have rested on that day, too?
Never heard that one.
That's a good one.
The review you had on Shark Sandwich, which was merely a two-word review, just said, sandwich.
Where'd they print that?
That's not real, is it?
You can't print that.
I swear Lester Bangs wrote that review. You know, there's just so much truth in all of what you guys captured.
It's like in the Almost Famous, yeah.
Yeah.
And J.D. Considine became famous for those two-word reviews.
Oh, yeah.
You guys actually beat him to the punch with that stuff. Yeah. And what's funny to see, when you talk about the improv, you could actually see it happening on the screen where you'll see the other guys reacting to a line, and they're like, you can tell they've never heard it before, and they are trying to suppress a big laugh, you know, while
it was interesting, but because... we'd shoot a scene, and then I would shoot it again. You know, I shoot it a couple of times to see what else would come out. And sometimes, you know, I tell Peter Smokler, just don't cover anybody who's talking, just people listening, so I can have cutaways, you know. And Chris never said the same thing twice. He could never remember what he said ever. So he never said the same thing twice. It was great.
If you can see,
the
numbers all go to 11. Look, right across the board. Oh. 11, oh, 11,
and most of
11,
these
and then
amps go up to 10.
Exactly.
Does that mean it's louder? Is it any louder?
Well, it's one louder, isn't it? It's not 10. You see, most blokes, you know, be playing at 10. You're on 10 here, all the way up, all the way up, all the way up. You're on 10 on your guitar. Where can you go from there? Where?
I don't know.
Nowhere, exactly. What we do is, if we need that extra push over the cliff, you know what we do?
Put it up to 11.
11, exactly. One louder.
Why don't you just make 10 louder and make 10 be the top number and make that a little louder?
These go to 11.
Peter Smokler, director of photography, who had shot Give Me Shelter with, you know,
well,
the
reason,
Altamont.
The reason I hired Peter Smokler is because he had shot rock and roll documentaries. He was at Altamont and had shot other documentaries. And my favorite thing was when we were making Spinal Tap, he says, the whole time we're making it, he says to me, what's funny about this? He said, this is exactly what happens. And I said, yeah, but Peter, you're not seeing it. It's a little bit bent. I mean, but we basically took from everything we knew. I mean, the scene backstage where he's complaining about the small bread was taken from, you know, the article we read about Van Halen and the Endless Party, where they said they had in their rider no brown M&Ms.
Well, no, there's some problems here. I don't even know where to start. All right. This
sound check?
This. Look, there's a little problem with the, this miniature bread. It's like, I've been working with this now for about half an hour, and I can't figure out, let's say I want a bite, right? You got this?
You'd like bigger bread?
Exactly. I don't understand how...
You could fold this, though. I mean, you could
fold it. No, then it's half the size.
No, not the bread.
You can fold the meat.
Yeah, but then it breaks apart.
No,
like this.
You put it on the bread like this, see?
But then if you keep folding it, it keeps breaking. And then everything has to be folded.
The scene where they couldn't find the stage was taken from a Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers concert where they got stoned backstage and couldn't find the stage.
We've got to get to a subway. We're in the group. Right, sure. We're in the group that's playing tonight.
You go right straight through this door here, down the hall.
Yeah.
Turn right.
Yeah.
And then there's a little jog there, about 30 feet. Jog to the left.
We don't have time for that.
Go straight ahead.
We'll trust you. We'll trust you.
Go straight ahead.
Yeah.
Turn right the next two corners. And the first door you sign, authorized personnel only.
Yeah.
Open that door. That's the stage.
You think so?
You authorize. You're musicians, aren't you?
Yeah. All right, thank you. Thank you very much. Rock and roll.
And when they get booked into the Air Force Base, the original keyboardist that we had in the 20-minute version was a guy named John Sinclair, who was a British guy, great keyboard player, and we wanted him for the film. And just when we were ready to start shooting, he got an actual gig with a group called Uriah Heep. They had an album out called Abominog, and they were touring. And so at one point during the tour, he comes and visits us and tells us, you know, we got booked into this military base. It was the strangest booking we've ever had. So, boom, we put it right into the movie. So,
truth.
We're going to the Air Force Base.
Why are we going to an Air Force Base?
Because the original gig fell through.
Hoekstra, you are Spinal Tap?
I'm Janine Pettigrew, and this is Spinal Tap.
Spinal Tap, my mistake. I'm Lieutenant Bob Hoekstra. Welcome to Lindbergh Air Force Base. This is your gentleman's first visit to a military facility.
Yes.
Fine, may I start by saying how thrilled we are to have you here. We are such fans of your music and all of your records.
That's right.
I'm not speaking of yours personally, but the whole genre, the rock and roll and so many of the exciting things that are happening in music today.
So you're rock and roll fans. You're coming at it from a standpoint of love, I think, in a lot of ways. Because you love this music.
Love
and you
love
and you researched it to death and you knew the stories better than the bands did in some
cases. We love rock and roll, but we also are satirists. And we know how to make fun of it and one of my favorite things is you know they're not geniuses, a lot of the people who play
Tell
rock and
us,
roll
Rob.
So we did this thing with Stonehenge where there's the 18 inch thing. It was supposed to be 18 feet with the Stonehenge. We did the whole thing, and then Black Sabbath, about 2 weeks before the film came out, Black Sabbath was touring with a Stonehenge motif, and they got furious at us because they thought we had stolen it from them. Now, you understand, the film came out 2 weeks
after.
I mean, it took us 2 years to make this film. It's not like you put a film, you shoot it and put it together and it gets in the theater in 2 weeks. It was just the dumbness of them thinking that we had stole this idea from them.
Find out I'm the chosen one. Oh, no!
Well, when you first hear the film or see the film, I think you appreciate the laughs and just sort of almost this mockumentary approach, like these guys are idiots and we're kind of laughing at them.
But we love them too.
But that comes out later. As you watch the film more, I think what really makes the film great is there's almost a bittersweet melancholy. Like it's almost too real. Yeah, this really does happen. And, these guys are, they believe too. They believe to their core. This is the only thing they can do.
Right.
You realize the alternative to this would have been washing dishes at Denny's or something like that.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like this beautiful thing that you're documenting. And at the same time, it is a really harsh kind of like look at these guys, it sounds like a glorious life, but it really isn't.
Well, did you see the documentary that was done? Oddly enough, I mean, the drummer, I mean, the guy's name, Rob Reiner.
Anvil.
It was, this is Anvil, I think. Or and then it's at a colon, the story of Anvil.
Right.
I mean, it is these guys who love playing rock and roll, who they'd rather do anything but that. And it's kind of sad. And at the same time, it's funny. And I thought that was, it was almost like, art imitating life, imitating art, imitating life. Yeah. It just kept going in a circle.
The Metallica documentary where they all go to therapy together.
Yeah. I love in Anvil, they actually went and visited Stonehenge. Now, I think they must have done that knowing that we had that in the film. They had to have done that. I don't think that they actually did.
Well, it's become such a trope among rock bands. I mean, I rare is the rock band that doesn't watch that movie before going out on tour.
Yeah.
So then does their life imitate it because they just watched it?
Well, it's interesting because when I was doing Princess Bride, Sting came in to meet with me for possibly playing a part, and he told me that he had seen the movie. He said, I watch it over and over. And he says, when we go on tour, and he says, every time I watch it, he says, I don't know whether to laugh or cry.
Exactly.
And that was like the perfect description.
Well, you said something earlier about helping to write the lyrics, and I find that fascinating. I don't think I've ever read that before. I assume that the three boys went off and you know, jammed in a rehearsal space and came up with those songs. But I remember seeing Spinal Tap at CBGB not long after the movie came out, because I was a kid growing up in New York.
Wow, yeah.
And, I mean, they were a band.
You're free to just fall feet, and you still got your baby teeth. You're too young and I'm too well hung, but tonight I'm gonna rock you.
Yes, they were a band. Michael played with the Left Bank at one point. Harry and Chris all played with bands at different points. Harry's a really good bass player.
Yeah.
Yeah, he still plays. And Chris is a really good, plays mandolin, plays guitar. I mean, these guys, and they write their own songs. I mean, and it wouldn't have worked unless you had a real band. And by the way, all the music that you hear in the movie was recorded live. Mm. We didn't record any of that in the studio.
So were you sitting with them while they were writing songs or recording?
Well, we recorded afterwards, you know, to make an album. But no, we didn't record. Like I said, we performed live. And so, no, I wasn't there when they wrote the music, you know. But when we all kind of collaborated on the lyrics, like Big Bottom and Hell Hole.
Listening to Sound Opinions, our guest is Rob Reiner, director and star of This Is Spinal Tap. Rob, we're talking about this film on its 30th anniversary, and everybody acknowledges that it's a classic. I mean, we're talking about the Library of Congress, the Smithsonian, but it was not well received when it came out, people didn't understand it.
I mean, satire, you know, the classic phrase, satire is what closes on Saturday night. People don't get it. We first previewed this movie in Dallas. And people just didn't know what it was. I mean, they looked, and people came up to me after the screening. I said, I don't understand why you would make a movie about a band that nobody's ever heard of and, and one that's so bad. And I said, well, it's a satire, you know. And they said, well, why wouldn't you make a movie about the Beatles or the Rolling Stones or something? And they just didn't get it. I mean, it went over their heads. It took a while, over a period of years, for people to really understand what it was.
Looking back on it, did you see this happening where the influence, where it started to influence the way bands perform and stage tours and reference it as like, okay, we're, you know, this was a Spinal Tap moment. It has become part of the language.
Yeah, no, you don't. You don't know. I mean, a satire, if it's good and it's close to the bone, which this was, you're trying to capture actually what goes on. So, I mean, it's not like I say, we're art imitating life. And so if it's close enough, then the life that goes on after is going to, by definition, imitate what you've done. So, no, but you don't know that people are going to reference you. You thought, you know, you make a movie and then it goes away and then nobody ever hears from it again.
It sounds like you've got enough outtakes to make like three more movies.
Well, the interesting thing is when we had the first cut of the movie, which didn't include any of the interview footage. We had interview footage of about 3 hours, and the first cut of the movie was 4.5 hours.
Wow.
Without the interview footage.
Wow.
So, I mean, we basically wrote the film in the cutting room.
And you've never been tempted to put all that stuff out? Because you know people would suck it up.
You know, I don't even own the rights to it anymore. And that's one of the sad stories about this thing. None of us have ever seen a penny from any of the Spinal Tap stuff.
Now, and it's art imitating life imitating. That's the Robert Johnson story.
I know, it is the Robert Johnson. We have not seen a penny of it, and it's upsetting to all of us.
Wow.
And so are we going to put it out? No, we don't want it. Unless somebody, you know, who owns this thing says, hey, you know, you guys deserve something. We have never gotten anything.
I think there needs to be like a Band-Aid kind of concert to get Spinal Tap its rights back.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, Sting and all these fans
can come and play. We performed at this Earth Day thing, you know, at Wembley.
Yeah.
Wembley Stadium. And Ricky Gervais introduced me as Marty DeBurgi, and I introduced the band. And they played in front of, like, you know, 80,000 people. So you know, maybe somebody should do a benefit concert for us.
Hello, Wimbledon! Ancient times, hundreds of years before the dawn of history, lived a strange race of people, the Druids.
We've been talking to Rob Reiner, the director of This Is Spinal Tap. His new movie, And So It Goes, is out next week. Rob, thanks so much for being our guest.
Thanks for having me.
But their legacy remains, hewn into the living rock of Stone Age.
To watch video of this conversation, visit soundopinions.org. And while you're there, you can get info on our July 29th screening of Spinal Tap in Millennium Park. Now, what are your favorite memories of the movie? Where does it rank among rock movies? What are the real-life Spinal Tap moments you laugh at? Have you ever seen the extended version? Call 888-859-1800. Coming up, a new album by The Moz and Greg's addition to the Desert Island Jukebox. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX.
Stonehenge, it's a magic place where the moon flies from the dragon's face. Stonehenge, where the birds fly and the prayers of devils fill the midnight sky.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Jim DeRogatis. My partner is Greg Kot. And that is the king of the gladiolas himself, Morrissey, with the first single from his new album, title track, World Peace Is None of Your Business. Album number 10 in the solo Moz discography, Greg. Of course, he started out in the 80s as the lead singer of the Smiths. We recently learned that his two big inspirations were Patti Smith and Oscar Wilde. And I always have thought of him as the Oscar Wilde of rock and roll. We learned that in the big bestseller, the autobiography, topped the charts in the UK, came out via Penguin Classics. And it really underscored that Morrissey's always been as much a writer and a character as he has been a musician. He said in 2012 that he was going to be retiring. And in typically perverse fashion, he's continued to tour, although he's had to cancel quite a few shows over the last couple of years. There was an ulcer, there was a bout with pneumonia, there was a head cold, and now we have this album. He's got a new collaborator by the name of Gustavo Manzur, and the album World Peace Is None of Your Business has just dropped. Let's play a track from it, and we'll come back and give our opinions. The song is called Neil Cassady Drops Dead by Morrissey on Sound Opinions.
Neil Cassady drops dead, and Allen Ginsberg's tear shampoo his beard. Neil Cassady drops dead, and Allen Ginsberg's lips tighten and thin. Neil Cassady drops dead, and Allen Ginsberg's hose down in a barn. Neil Cassady drops dead, and Allen Ginsberg's howl becomes a growl. Everyone has babies, babies full of rabies, rabies full of scabies. Scarlet has a fever, ringlets full of ringworm, angel of distemper. The little fella has got rubella, nipper full of fungus, junior full of gangrene, minor's melanoma, tyke full of gripe, whippersnapper scurvy, urchin made of acne. Get that thing away from me. Victim, all life's adventurer. Which of the two are you? Victim, all life's adventurer. Which of the two are you?
That is Morrissey with Neil Cassady Drops Dead on Sound Opinions. The new album is called World Peace Is None of Your Business. And that's a tip-off, Jim. This is the Morrissey State of the World address. You know, I don't think he's ever been more political on a record. He's always addressed social topics, but he's very direct on this record. It's also a much slower, more brooding record. I mean, we've always associated Morrissey with a certain level of misanthropy. Very few people are up to his standards, and there are even fewer of those people on this record. He is an incredibly bitter, sour mood. I mean, he's just turned 55. Maybe that's part of it. I really miss the biting humor that he would bring to his most poisonous bromides against the world. Here, he's sort of in a humorless mood half the time.
Well, the targets have become obscured, too. In Kick the Bride Down the Aisle, he's mocking women who are ready to submit themselves to the man, and he calls them cows, which is, like, you know, not very nice.
I would say that's misogynist.
Yes.
I'm not, again, very surprising to hear that from Morrissey on this record. But the stuff that does get to me is the more empathetic stuff. There's a song called Mountjoy, which is, I take it, about the Dublin prison, which is in keeping with the orchestration and the more elegiac mood of a lot of this record. It's not up-tempo at all, but it really fits the sentiment in this song, the empathy that he's expressing there. So there are some new shades of Morrissey on this record. It isn't entirely as successful as, say, Years of Refusal was a few years ago, his last previous record, which I liked quite a bit. It's a try-it record by Morrissey standards.
I'll double that try-it, Greg. That's the best I can do. You're right. He's not at his best. He's not at his most Oscar Wilde. You know, inexplicably, that song, Neil Cassady Drops Dead, turns from a musing of Allen Ginsberg feeling lost with his lover gone, Neil Cassady in the Beat era, to a rant against how evil babies are. Babies have rabies and scabies, Morrissey tells us. Really? Not his lyrical best. And then the musical problem. You didn't mention that at all. I think there are some moments of great guitar noise. I love the way that that title track erupts into that Nine Inch Nails guitar. And there's a lot of that on the album, but not in a sustained way. The idea of Morrissey fronting Reznor-like sounds is kind of exciting to me. But then there's these other meandering tracks that are full of didgeridoo, and no good comes from didgeridoo or has since the Aphex Twin. So, you know, musically and lyrically, it's just a big disappointment. It's a try it from me, and no doubt will earn the villainy of all of the Morrissey lovers. But I'm sorry, I also eat hamburgers.
I tell you, little buddy, this whole island is bewitched.
You remember, we were shipwrecked together.
As often as possible here on Sound Opinions, we like to take a trip to the desert island and play a song on the jukebox that we can't live without. Greg, it's your turn. What do you got?
Well, Jim, this is a band that you would have to go to a desert island to find their record. I mean, it was impossible to find after they recorded it in 1975. It got effectively buried by their record company. The name of the band is Death, not to be mistaken for the metal band of more recent vintage. This is a Detroit punk band from the early 70s. The name of the record was For the Whole World to See. It finally came out a few years ago thanks to a Chicago label named Drag City that finally released it. It was basically a band consisting of three siblings from East Detroit, David, Bobby, and Dennis Hackney. They had this raw rock edge, kind of a African-American response to what was going on in Detroit at the time with MC5 and the Stooges, sort of a political bent to some of the songs, but also this sound, abrasive, declarative. There was no bones about where they stood on issues like the war, poverty, the way African-Americans were being mistreated in the inner city. In many ways, the precursors to bands like Bad Brains or Living Color, but they never got the attention for it because their record never came out. The guy who signed them to a label deal, one Clive Davis, we've talked about Clive a few times on this show, wanted them to change their name. He basically said, boys, I'm not going to put your record out unless you change that name. Nobody's going to buy a record by a band named Death. And, of course, the guys refused. They basically broke up after that, have reunited, however, that's the happy ending to this story, have reunited in recent years since their record finally did come out. And people are now acknowledging it as a classic, ahead of its time. Here's one of the tracks from that record, Politicians in My Eyes, from Death on Sound Opinions.
Politicians in my eyes. We did out shaking hands.
That is Death with Politicians in My Eyes, Greg Kot's Desert Island Jukebox pick this week. A good one, Greg. What do we have on the show next week?
Next week, Jim, in studio visit, interview, performance from the great Roseanne Cash.
Sound Opinion senior producers are Robin Lynn and Jason Saldana. Our production assistant is Anthony Martinez, and our intern is Sam Taylor. On Sound Opinions, everyone's a critic. So now it's time to hear what you have to say.
Bus line is busy every time that I phone. Bus is the longest talker I ever known. Bus, I've been trying hard to reach him all day. Bus, when I get him, I forget what to say.
New messages.
Hey, Jim. This is Paul calling from Syracuse, New York. I really loved the Buried Treasure show that you and Greg put together, but I got to ask, do you really like Gotta Girl because you hate Lana Del Rey that much? I'm sorry, man. I know Lana's not the greatest, but neither is Gotta Girl. It's just Euro cheese, just bad lounge music. And while Mary might have a slightly better voice than Lana Del Rey, the bar is not really high there, and her voice isn't that great. That song you played is strictly a case of production magic. You strip away all the bells and whistles, and there's really not much there. You did redeem yourself, man, with a muff. That was badass. I love that. Anyways, love the show. Keep up the great work. Thanks. Bye.
Hey, guys. It's Jake calling from Chicago. Love the show. Just heard the review on First Aid. Just wanted to say, is it really that shocking that two cute girls from the suburbs of Stockholm who sing country music were signed to a major label? I don't know. It seems like on paper it would just read, this would tell.
There's music and there's laughter. I don't know if I'm scared of dying, but I'm scared of living too fast, too slow. Regret, remorse, hold on. No, I gotta go. So try not to hold on to what is gone. I try to do right what is wrong. I try to keep on keeping on. Yeah, I just keep on keeping on. I hear a voice call.
Greetings, Jim and Greg. This is Peter. I'm calling from El Cerrito, California, and I've been sort of meaning to call and suggest this for quite some time, but I was just inspired to do so by your review of the Bob Mould album, your super positive review, which I went out and got. There's something that I think is just a scourge of music these days, and that is the auto-tune plugin. It's everywhere, and so much of the music that you guys review is horribly infected by auto-tune. Not like Cher robot auto-tune, but if you know what to listen for, you realize a person can't possibly sing that way. And sure enough, the Bob Mould record, 35 seconds into the very first song, there is horrible auto-tune right there. Why is it so important for musicians to use this thing? What happened to vocal imperfection? Why is that a bad thing? So, auto-tune must die. You should think about this. Bye.
Hi, my name is Marie, and I'm calling about the interview with Wendy and Lisa. And, you know, I kind of got the impression that you thought that basically, like, Prince's career had gone down after Wendy and Lisa left. And, I mean, to me, maybe that's a fact in terms of commercial success or record sales, but the quality of his music and the level of his output is fantastic, and Wendy and Lisa were just a drop in the bucket, you know, in my opinion. All right, thanks. Bye.
I can hang when you're around, but I surely die if you're not there. Love, come quick. Love, come quick.
no more messages.
To share your opinions on Sound Opinions, call 888-859-1800. We'll be back next week on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and distributed by PRX.